Hello, you're listening to the Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 48, part 2. Welcome back. Thanks for hanging in there. I hope you're liking the, this is an experiment. I don't know if this is going to be a permanent thing or not, but we had a request from between the last podcast and this one for a shorter recording. So we're going to give this a shot, and please give me feedback and let me know what you think about that. Feedback line, as far as email is concerned, is feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. The voicemail feedback line is area code 304-99-PILOT. That's 304-997-4568. And you can also go to the website, Airline Pilot Guy or Catholic Pilot, and head over there to the right side, look for that tab, click on it, and it'll, if your computer has a built-in microphone, or better yet, an external microphone connected, it'll use that and make a really nice high-quality recording, and it puts it in my inbox for feedback. So many, many ways to send me feedback and questions. So speaking of that, let's move on, shall we? My good friend, who also is the host of a very, very good podcast, Just a Catholic Dad, Sean McCarney. He's an air traffic controller at Farnborough Airport in just southwest of London, I believe. He sent me this article, and the title of it is EU Suspends Extension of Plane Emissions Trading Rules. They have postponed a planned extension of the rules that require airlines to pay for their carbon emissions to include flights to and from non-EU destinations. Now, right now, I guess earlier this year, they started applying this tax to airplanes, whereas before it was only limited to, industries, factories, and other land-based emitters of CO2, but it was extended to cover aircraft at the start of this year. And it right now, the way it was being used was for only internal flights in the European Union that begin and end within the 27-country bloc. However, some countries outside of the European Union have been objecting to the fee structure for CO2 emissions. India and China have been among the most vocal opponents, with India banning its airlines from complying with it in April. So they have put this on hold and hoping that the International Civil Aviation Organization will come up with some kind of a trading scheme that will be acceptable to everyone involved. Aircraft using airports within the EU must pay a tax on each ton of CO2 emitted. The airlines have said that this will cost them 17.5 billion euros, and that's 22.3 billion US, or 14 billion pounds, over 8 years. But the EU has argued that it only adds between 4 and 24 euros to the price of a long-haul flight. Well, it's still adding money to the cost of your ticket, something that we just can't afford. So, thank you, Sean, for sending that to me. Appreciate it. Brian Chen sends me this. Thanks for the podcast. I live in Anchorage and often wondered about airplanes landing in high winds with gusts. We often have hurricane-force winds here in Anchorage. Everyone knows that landing at Ted Stevens during the winter is very, very rough. It is not uncommon that the gusts are over 100 miles per hour, but flights are almost never canceled or diverted. However, it seems like flights are often canceled or diverted due to high wind situations at the other airports in the lower 48. Is this just my perception? Brian. Well, I don't know for sure, Brian, if it's just perception or if there are the same percentage of flights that are canceled due to high winds. But honestly, in the contiguous United States, the states outside of Alaska and Hawaii, the I don't think the wind speeds get up so high like they do in Anchorage, up, you know, over 100 miles per hour very often. And so I think that might be one of the reasons. The other is that the winds that you're talking about in Anchorage, again, I'm just kind of answering this by the seat of my pants here. I don't know for sure. I didn't do any research on it. But I'm guessing that most of the time these winds are aligned with the landing and takeoff runways, so that, you know, we can land in pretty high winds as long as they're aligned pretty much, you know, within 10 or 20 degrees of the runway heading. When they start getting more than 30 degrees off of the runway heading, they start turning in more into a crosswind component. And that is the limitation on airplanes. So when the wind is coming from, you know, 45, 50, 60, 70, 90 degrees off of the runway heading, then that wind component turns into almost a pure crosswind, and that's when the crosswind limitations come into play for airplanes, and that's when flights are canceled. The reason for this, of course, is that when you land a transport category airplane, you want the fuselage aligned with the runway heading. And so in order to do that, as the airplane gets lower and lower and lower, and just before landing, and depending on the technique of the pilot, I'm one who probably starts putting in crosswind controls earlier than most. Some will go all the way down until they're flaring, and then they'll kick the rudder in and try to align the fuselage with the runway. I tend to do it a couple hundred feet before touchdown. And when you do that, you, in order to keep the airplane from being blown away from the runway, you have to lower the wing into the wind to keep, you know, the airplane going toward the runway. And there are, when the wind is gets so high that you have to really put in a lot of bank to keep the airplane from, you know, scooting left or right, you risk touching the tip of the wing on the runway. So that's why crosswinds are such, or tip of the wing, or even the bottom of the engine nacelle if it's a wing-mounted engine. So that's why crosswind limitations are a factor with really, really high crosswinds. Now, when the wind is coming straight down the runway in your face, well, who cares, right? I mean, that wing loves wind, relative wind over it, because that's what creates lift. So, you know, having 100-knot wind in your, you know, directly in front of you, in your face, aligned with the runway, is not a problem. So that's just something to think about. Maybe that's why. Maybe some of the cancellations in our country with high winds is because the winds are crosswinds. They're not aligned with the runways. Just my guess. Hey, let's listen to some voice feedback. I haven't played any yet. I didn't play any at all in part one. So let's.
Captain. Incoming message.
Thank you. Here we go. Mike Rogers.
Hi, Captain Jeff. This is Mike Rogers calling. I'm the guy in Northwest Missouri who I think you'd referred to a couple of podcasts ago. You had said that you were in either Des Moines or Kansas City or possibly even Omaha, and you had said that there was someone in the area who talked about going out to dinner with you. That would have been me. And if when you're back next in that area, please feel free to contact me. I've been gathering input from a couple of different or feedback from a couple of different podcasts. So sorry if these sort of all run together, but I have to say that I just love the podcast that you did on Tamtastic. I was really on the edge of my seat while I was listening to it, and it happens that normally I listen to your podcast while biking to work, so it was a little bit precarious, but it wasn't clear when I was listening to that podcast that the crew really knew what was going on, and the second in command, or at least the person operating the radio, just sort of seemed to be parroting exactly what ATC said, and so I don't know about that, but I was wondering if the nose wheel hadn't straightened out at the last moment, I'm assuming it would have sheared off, and if so, would that have been any worse than a normal gear-up landing? I was just sort of curious about that. And I had a couple of other questions. I was wondering, when you go flying, and do you get a weather briefing yourself? I mean, do you actually call up flight service or somebody like that? Or does someone at ACME sort of do that for you and just say, here's what the weather is going to be? And I know when I do a pre-flight, I walk around my very, very, very small airplane and I check to see if the controls are working properly just by looking to see if the controls are working properly. And I was wondering how you do that in your very much larger airplane, because I'm presuming you can't really see the control surfaces from where you are in the cockpit at the back. There was another podcast where you had asked about feedback about safety and I think ergonomics, sort of in terms of how those panels were laid out. And I use, I fly via steam gauges. I've looked at all the sort of fancy new displays, and I'm not convinced that for a pilot like myself that they would be any safer. With steam gauges, you have information isolated in different areas. I know that if I look at one place, I'm going to see the altitude there and nothing else. If I look at another place, I'm going to see airspeed, and I'll never get them confused. So that's my take. I guess I'm sort of a Luddite when it comes to instrumentation, even though I do have a Garmin GPS. That... Hi, Captain Jeff. This is Mike Rogers with part two of my feedback, because your phone hung up on me. I don't know if it couldn't hear me or what, but anyway, I've been talking about safety and ergonomics and steam gauges, and I think I've gotten to more or less where I wanted to be. One other question that I was wondering is, I've noticed that when airliners are taxiing, they do a phenomenally good job of staying right on the center line of where they're supposed to be taxiing. And I confess, I'm a little bit more lax, because in the plane that I'm flying, which is a Skyhawk, I've got a whole lot more wiggle room. And I was just wondering, how do you stay exactly on the center line? Is there some special mechanism that makes that happen, or is it just you're very vigilant? And one last thing that I wanted to mention, okay, maybe I have a couple last things that I wanted to mention, but I was listening to an article, in fact, it was another podcast, it was called Ideas on the CBC, and it was about something called Habakkuk, and this was a project during World War II that sounds unbelievably far-fetched, but they were planning to make an aircraft carrier out of ice, and they had very good reasons for doing that. And it was called Habakkuk, H-A-B-B-A-K-U-K, and they never got around to building it, but it sounded like it would have been a very interesting thing to land on. So that is about it, and I enjoy your podcasts immensely all the time. I sometimes think that you ought to, in addition to your podcasts, maybe at some point in time, you ought to consider setting up like a call-in show using Skype. And I think that would be just sort of interesting. I don't know if that could happen, but just sort of some food for thought. Anyways, that's about it. Have a good day. Bye.
Well, thanks, Mike. First of all, let me apologize. I think that the Google Voice telephone service that I use, let me pull this out here. I think I'm getting some interference from the power supply here on my iPhone. No, I guess that didn't do it. I hear a little bit of a clicking noise in the background. Sorry about that. Anyway, I think that the Google Voice answering component is set up to for a maximum of a 3-minute message. I'll see if I can find a setting to change to see if I can accept longer recordings for voicemails, but I think that's what happened there. You just ran out of time, and you had to put another dime or quarter or, well, the good old days. Remember those payphones? Anyway, the nose gear cocked on the TAM Airbus 330 that flew from Brazil to John F. Kennedy, well, that was an interesting incident, and the cool thing about it was that I was able to find that recording. You know, anything happening at John F. Kennedy, you can automatically assume that you're going to have that air traffic control recording. And so I was thrilled when I saw that. And it had me on the edge of my seat as well. And what a miracle at the last minute, you know, right when the main gear was touching down, that nose wheel straightened out. And everything was just fine. And I agree with you. The first officer seemed to be just parroting commands or the instructions from air traffic control. Of course, that's what we all do. But in this case, it did seem more like she didn't quite grasp, or maybe the pilots of that flight didn't quite grasp the gravity of what was happening with their nose wheel. And also, it may have something to do with the language barrier, because remember, you know, English is not their primary language, so that could have played a part in it as well. So, yeah, that was, you mentioned or asked what would have happened if it hadn't straightened out. Well, we have experience, at least one that I can think of off the top of my head, a highly publicized, in fact, when it was occurring, it was a JetBlue, I think it was a 320, a JetBlue originally scheduled to land at Long Beach Airport in Southern California, but they ended up taking it into Los Angeles International to have a little bit longer runway and also have a little bit more support from, you know, air crash, fire, rescue, and other support mechanisms. And because they had to burn fuel down to make the airplane as light as possible and have as little fuel in the wings as possible, just in case something happened on landing. And because in this day and time we live where communications is almost constant, people were notified when this was happening. And so we were able to actually watch this as a live event. You may have been watching the television coverage of this. They had, you know, the news helicopters were out there. We were actually watching this airplane as it was holding and coming in for approach and landing at Los Angeles International. And sure enough, the nose wheels were cocked 90 degrees. And when it touched down, it was kind of like, well, that wasn't a big deal at all. You know, the rubber scraped away, there were some sparks, and they stopped straight ahead, right smack dab on the center line. So the nose gear stayed up. Well, I shouldn't say up. The nose gear stayed down and locked, and everybody got out uninjured. So I'm assuming that the same would have happened with this Airbus 330. I think that it probably a more dire situation would have been if the nose wheel tires were aligned maybe at a 45-degree angle instead of a 90-degree angle. I'm not sure they've had any kind of incident like that in the past or not. But so that's what would have happened if it hadn't straightened. Probably nothing, except, you know, some damage, a little bit of damage to the nose gear assembly. And that's about it. As far as weather briefings are concerned, no, we don't use the flight service station to get our own weather. Most airlines either have, well, ACME has its own meteorology department. And I think a lot of the major legacy carriers used to have their own meteorology departments, but now contract with services like Weather Underground or ASI, several different professional providers of weather data to their various companies. And in my case at ACME, we don't go in front of a weather desk and get a one-on-one briefing or even a telephone briefing. We actually just get text printed out. You know, we have our flight plan data, and then somewhere below the flight plan information is the weather data. And it talks about, it gives it all the METARs and the TAFs and turbulence plots and other things that may be affecting our flight. In other words, turbulence, thunderstorms, icing conditions, low visibilities, that kind of thing. So that's how we get it. And so when we pick up our flight plan, when we arrive at the gate, we look at and read the weather briefing. Now, some of us, like me, also use other sources for their weather in addition to the official weather briefing that we're required to look at. I like to use Weather Underground on my iPhone or computer, and that gives me some data to look at. I also like to use the National Weather Service's site, the ADDS. What does that stand for? Aviation Digital Data Service, I think, part of the National Oceanic and Aeronautics, NOAA. I'm not sure exactly what that stands for either. But a really great source of meteorological information for pilots. It has convection information. I look at the convection plots, the extended convection outlook. I look at the turbulence plots. You can put it in for the time frame that you're going to be flying and the flight level that you're going to be flying, or pretty close to that. All kinds of information there. It's a veritable cornucopia of weather information available for pilots. So check that. I'll try to remember to put a link to the ADDS. Just do a search on Google or Bing or your favorite search engine for ADDS, and you'll see all that good stuff there. So let's see, steam gauges versus newer displays. Yeah, I'm like you. I think it has a lot to do, Mike, with what you were using when you learned how to fly. So those of us who kind of learned how to fly using the old-fashioned gauges and that T instrument cross-check kind of pattern, we're used to that. It's comfortable to us. We like some, you know, most of us like the newer displays as well, but it's kind of nice and comforting to go back to the old steam gauges and the old-fashioned instrument cross-check layout. I think we have an advantage over the new people because, you know, a lot of the instrumentation that's there in case you are in big trouble and you lose all your power and you're on backup power and using standby instrumentation, if you don't have that experience looking at that old-fashioned stuff, you're probably going to, you know, not be very comfortable at all. So, but I'm like you. I like the old-fashioned stuff myself, again, because that's what I cut my teeth on. That's how I learned how to fly airplanes via instruments. And not so sure if it's safer or not. Again, well, time will tell, I guess. Taxiing. Another question about taxiing. How do you guys stay on the center line? Well, first of all, I understand when you're in a Skyhawk, you don't have to really worry about being smack dab nose wheel on that center line because your wingspan is not very large. Even the airplane that I fly, 108 feet, I think, from tip to tip, as far as wingspan is concerned, for transport category aircraft, pretty, not very large or, you know, wide. So I can kind of get away with not always being right smack dab on the center line. Now, of course, when I get into areas where it's pretty congested, you can be sure that my nose wheel is on that center line, because if I ding a wingtip, it's probably still going to be my fault, but you know, I'm going to have a better chance of keeping clear of obstacles when I'm right on the middle, you know, right there on that center line. The bigger the airplane you fly, the more important it is that your nose wheel be on that center line. You know, we've talked about incidents on this show and other podcasts talking about, you know, airplane wingtips hitting tails of other airplanes, et cetera, because they were, well, in these cases, I think they were actually on the center line of the taxiway. It's just that they didn't ensure that they had proper clearance with the airplanes they collided with. So I'm not so sure that's a factor. But anyway, it's just for safety. It's the best bet. If you're going to try to keep from hitting anything with your wingtips, you have to be cognizant of where your wingtips are and where other obstacles are, and you're safest when your nose wheel is on the taxi line. How do we do it? Well, it's just experience, I guess. Just being vigilant, as you said. Okay, and regarding Habakkuk, well, I did a search on Google for Habakkuk, and I spelled it the way you dispelled it, which is the spelling of the biblical prophet in the Old Testament. Not a lot is known about Habakkuk. There is a book in the Old Testament named for Habakkuk. But the spelling of the project of the aircraft carrier made from ice is actually H-A-B-A-K-K-U-K. It's actually a misspelling. And they think that the guy that came up with this concept, Jeffrey Pike, in the UK. Just actually didn't know how to spell it. So he spelled it wrong, and that became the official spelling for the project Habakkuk. Pyle was chief of combined operations. No, I'm sorry. He was an old friend of J.D. Bernal and originally been recommended to Lord Mountbatten, chief of combined operations, by the cabinet minister. Pike worked in the operation headquarters in England and was regarded as a genius. He conceived this idea of Habakkuk while in the United States, organizing the production of M29 Weasels for Project Plow. Never heard of that either. A scheme to assemble an elite unit for winter operations in Norway and Romania and the Italian Alps. And he had been considering the problem of how to protect seaborne landings and Atlantic convoys out of reach of aircraft cover. The problem was that steel and aluminum were in short supply, or aluminium for you Brits out there, were in short supply and required for other purposes. So Jeffrey Pike realized that the answer was ice, which could be manufactured for only 1% of the energy needed to make an equivalent mass of steel. He proposed that an iceberg, natural or artificial, be leveled to provide a runway and hollowed out to shelter aircraft. From New York, Pike sent the proposal he had composed via diplomatic bag to the Central Operation Headquarters with a label forbidding anyone other than Lord Mountbatten from opening the package. Mountbatten in turn told Churchill about Pike's proposal, who was very enthusiastic about it. And so basically, I'll include a link to the Wikipedia article regarding this this idea to make an aircraft carrier out of ice. And essentially, when they started doing tests, they realized that for this thing to be big enough and thick enough to sustain damage caused by artillery and that kind of thing, that the walls of the thing had to be like 40 or 50 feet wide or thick. And the means to keep the ice from melting, because it had to be a minimum of 50 feet above the level of the water. And so to make something that big and keep the ice from melting, they'd have to have really elaborate systems to keep the ice from melting. And so they started experimenting with using wood pulp in a mixture with water and freezing the material. And this solution, or this material, became known as pikecrete, obviously for pike, P-Y-K-E, and then rete, R-E-T-E, like concrete. And turns out that it was a success, and they experimented with various combinations of how much wood pulp to ice and water mixture and everything else. And they still had to accomplish cooling to keep it from melting with insulation systems and that kind of thing. But they actually did some large-scale tests at the Jasper National Park in Canada to examine insulation and refrigeration techniques and to see how the material would stand up to artillery and explosives. And then in Lake Louise, Alberta, large ice blocks were constructed, and a small prototype was constructed at Patricia Lake, Alberta, measuring only 60 by 30 feet, weighing in at 1,000 tons and kept frozen by a 1-horsepower motor. Anyway, it was they never did actually make a full-scale model of this. I'll include a picture of the thing as well. The thing is huge. But I thought that was a pretty cool idea, but it never came to fruition. I think things happened in the war, and they finally just put this thing in the back burner, and it never became a reality. But I'd never heard of anything like that. So thanks for pointing that out to me, Mike. Very cool. Again, I'll have a link in the show notes. Oh, look at that. We're at the 30-minute mark already, so It's time for us to end part two. So hang in there. Part three is coming up soon.